I'm Steve Potter, and this is Cityscape. Florian Schultz is a nature photographer whose work has appeared in National Geographic, among other magazines. He lectures on photography and conservation issues in America and Europe. And he's in St. Louis speaking earlier this week at the St. Louis Zoo. The event was sponsored by the Zoo, the St. Louis Academy of Science, and the Alaska Wilderness League. Florian Schultz, welcome to Cityscape.
Steve, I'm glad to be here.
Which came first for you, your love of photography or your advocacy of conservation issues?
You know, it was so early on in my life, actually as a teenager, that both of the things kind of came together at the same time. I was involved in an organization very similar to the Audubon Society in Germany, and we have a close-by nature reserve where I did, for example, bird walks as well as conservation measures where we cleaned up a bog and things like that. But I remember very clearly when I saw a fox that was run over with a car, and it was really, for me, a horrible sight because I loved, you know, watching foxes at the den and so on. So at night, I picked up my camera and went back to that same spot to show, unfortunately, that dead fox, but also the traffic in the background to tell already a small conservation story. Huh. And interestingly enough, that was one of my first awards that I got when I was 15 or years old in photography, and it went hand in hand with a conservation message.
So you still have that photograph, I'm sure.
Yes.
Oh, wow. when you lecture on conservation, are there specific issues that you're concerned about?
Yes, of course. For me, it's all about preserving habitat. It's about wilderness areas. And that's why I have such a big love for Alaska. Because, well, actually, my story started here in St. Louis. I was an exchange student and arrived here in the first stop over on my way out to America. And I came here because I wanted to photograph areas that still were the home for grizzly bears and wolves, the big open landscapes of the West. And that eventually brought me to Alaska because we don't have anything like it left in Germany.
Uh-huh. You're a founding member of something called the International League of Conservation Photographers.
That's right. Yeah, many years back, we realized that photography has such a great potential in reaching people. And often it's a single photograph that grabs someone's attention where otherwise you might be talking to that person or you know, writing about things for a really long time. But it's that image that relates to them that they say, you know what, I want to get involved with protecting this area.
There was a Omnimax 3D film recently at the St. Louis Science Center, To the Arctic, and you did the companion book to go with this. And some of the pictures, or one, you talk about a picture grabbing your attention. I saw it in National Geographic last summer, and I'm looking at it now. I guess it's the cover. It's the cover of your book, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this was before I knew. This was months ago, before I knew who you were, or that I'd ever meet you or talk to you. And I remembered the picture so vividly because, to me, it looks so perfect. It looked like it might be photoshopped. It's a picture of a bear bending down on some ice by the water, and there's a spine or some kind of vertebrae, you know, bone in the water, and then some birds in the background. I didn't think it could be photoshopped because it was in National Geographic and they didn't say it was. But it stuck to me. So explain this to me.
Yeah, that's exactly right. National Geographic would never publish a photoshopped image. A lot of my work is about a landscape that includes the wildlife, so you can really get an understanding of, you know, where these animals live. Here in this image, you have the polar bear that's filling half of the frame. And in the background, you see the spine of a fin whale, as well as the entire Arctic landscapes, glaciers and mountains in the background. Now, you have to imagine I was 18 months in the Arctic in the course of the years, and that was one of my most difficult photographs. I had set up a remote camera trigger, and so you have to imagine that polar bear is just about 3 to 4 feet away from the camera, and I'm triggering it as it's walking into the frame. There's a little bit of motion into it, and so it seems almost as if it's lifted off the background. But the beautiful thing is I have the whole thing videotaped how we got this image, and you can actually look at it online, maybe even here on the website, and see how the process went.
Well, when I'm looking at the background, you know, the spine and the birds, why do I think it's photoshopped? I mean,
I think it's because, and I, you know, sometimes people feel offended by something like that. Now I see it as a compliment because this image is so unique and so different. people have not seen it like that before. And that's why sometimes if it's an image like that, they say, well, it can't be real, must be fake mm-hmm. and Photoshopped. So I take it as a compliment now. And I have, you know, the good thing is some people may Photoshop something like this, but then when it comes down to it, they have to lie or it's right. really embarrassing. So I don't ever want to be there.
Well, I meant it as a compliment because it's absolutely beautiful. Let's talk more about this companion book to the Arctic. I think it contains more than 150 photographs, right? And did you tell me your relationship to the film? Were you along for the shooting of the film, and how did that work?
Yes, in part I was out there with the film crew, but the truth is that I actually photographed for this book for a much longer time, close to 18 months. I've spent up in the Arctic by now. The longest stretch was 5 months. To the Arctic is a beautiful 3D IMAX film that's in many different museums across the country, and I did the companion book. Some areas we were out together, and one of the most remarkable stories was, for example, how we were close to a polar bear mother and her two cubs. And the IMAX film shows that story, and I'm able to tell it in this book through my photographs. You have to imagine we were able to see that polar bear mother with her two cubs for close to a week, 24 hours a day, and really photograph and document every move, all her beautiful connection with the two little cubs, how she was nursing the cubs, how she was protecting them from big, powerful males. So that was something that has never been seen before like that.
But you were so close.
Yes, we were right there. In this case, we were out in an ice-going vessel, so it wasn't dangerous. But other times, you have to imagine me and my wife, for example, we're camping out on the frozen ocean during the wintertime looking for polar bears. And that is becoming really strenuous.
I've never been to the Arctic. I think most people that haven't have an impression of, I think it's described somewhere in your book as vast nothingness.
Exactly.
I mean, we picture a barren area, but your photographs certainly dispel all of that.
Yeah, that was in a way, my connection also with the Arctic and also with the Alaska Wilderness League. When some politicians called the Arctic a flat white nothingness or a barren wasteland, these conservation organizations, they asked me, can you go out there with your camera and see what you would discover? So I made that my project. I went out, for example, doing aerial shoots in some of the most remote areas in Alaska, like the National Petroleum Reserve. That's a place nobody has ever heard about. Some people know the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. But these areas now we're fighting about, the Arctic Ocean offshore, because Shell has had strong interest in drilling for oil there, but also in the National Petroleum Reserve for oil, as well as going into the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And with my imagery, I wanted to give an account of these incredible areas filled with hundreds of thousands of caribou, with snowy owls and many other species, so people could really picture them and also make a decision whether they wanted some of those areas protected.
We're talking with wildlife photographer Florian Schultz. He's done the book, the companion book, to the Omnimax film To the Arctic. And you talk about your images. I pulled out a couple of that grabbed me, and I thought maybe you'd just comment on them and share with us what you remember. Here's one, and you see very little ice in this one, but this is a snowy owl. What can you tell me about that?
Yeah, the snowy owl, and when you take a little closer look, there's even a little owl chick that's amongst the feathers of the adult. I had to sit for 72 hours in a blind until I finally was getting the perfect light I was wanting to show. It's 24-hour sunlight at this time of the year in the Arctic, so this image was actually taken at midnight after all this time in the tent, and it was finally that moment where the sun was breaking through the fog that was rolling in off the Arctic Ocean, and this image came to life.
I didn't have the patience for that, and I'm serious. I mean, does it sort of charge you up to be doing this and just as natural adrenaline or what?
Exactly. It's for me, I'm so passionate about the wildlife and about creating powerful images that's the drive that keeps me out there. Especially if you're, day after day, you are imagining these photographs that you want to get out. And this imagination of that final image is what keeps you so focused.
They don't usually turn out the way you imagine, do they?
Not all that often. I mean, one has to kind of swallow it. But once in a while when it does, you're beyond yourself, I guess.
Here's another one of your photographs to me that looks like the perfect one that must be Photoshopped because it's so perfect. And these are some sort of mammals in a blizzard.
Yeah, these are actually a group of musk oxen. And why it seems so surreal to you is because I'm photographing this in a blizzard. You have to imagine that the wind is picking up. You feel ice crystals in your face just like needles. And normally you kind of want to pack up your bags and go, you know, in a tent or a shelter or something. But I was out there because now I was able to show the Arctic with the true, you know, weather conditions, the elements. And the snow in this image is drifting so hard across the bottom that it seems like the animals are floating in the surreal light. And they're so perfectly lined up one after the other, almost in a formation that makes this image for me so special.
And the color of the animals, almost a reddish brown, is in such contrast to the surrounding.
Exactly, and that happened because it was really the last moments before the sunset during the February time in the Arctic.
Here's one from a distance, a herd of caribou, I don't know, a couple of hundred maybe.
Yeah, what you see here, that is, you know, a small section of the Western Arctic herd in the National Petroleum Reserve, one of those areas I just mentioned that no one knows about. This caribou herd is actually 500,000 animals strong. And I wanted to show this mass migration because most people can't even imagine it. And in this image, you see them all, they're all charging across the river and the water is splashing. So many hundreds of them in the same shot. They're almost the size of ants in this image so that you can imagine how many animals there are.
In your companion book, you have a lot of text there. Would you share just a little bit of what you wrote about your experience?
I gladly do. A loud crack in the ice snaps me out of my thoughts, and a bitter cold hits me again. The large orange moon hangs just above the mountains. From behind, I hear soft steps. It's my wife, Emile, all bundled up in a thick parka, polar bear pants, and kamek. Thick boots of polar bear fur that our Inuit guides have given to us to protect us against the cold. She climbs onto the plates of sea ice that form a pressure ridge at the edge of the fjord, and she looks up at the moon. I walk over to join her.
Well, what can we learn from the things you observed in the Arctic as far as conservation, as far as preserving wildlife? Are there lessons to be learned?
Well, on the one hand, the Arctic is this faraway place where most of us may never get to go. But at the other hand, it's a place that is all connected to the rest of us through the millions of migratory birds that also come by, you know, here, the Midwest, for example, through the migration. It's through the whales and many other. And also that we do need to care what's going on in the Arctic because the Arctic works in a way like a air conditioning unit for the rest of the world. So we can't just ignore, you know, the signs of climate change that we are noticing up there because it will affect us to more increased storms, you know, more severe weather. But that sometimes seems to be so big for people, they think, oh, I can't do anything about it. But the beauty here in Alaska, it's public land, a lot of the areas we're talking about. And if we are managing to protect some of these areas, like the National Petroleum Reserve or the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, or keep oil development off the Arctic Ocean, then I think we can make this difference that helps, on the one hand, you know, to keep down emissions of the, you know, CO2 and stuff from the oil and coal and so on. On the other hand, protect habitat, just like what we've done in Yellowstone and many of the other areas. And that's what Alaska Wilderness League and other conservation organizations are fighting for.
You have another book. I think it's called Freedom to Roam. That's also the name of an ongoing project that you have.
Absolutely. Freedom to Roam. I'm picking it up now that I've finished a book on the Arctic. Freedom to Roam has the concept about wildlife corridors, keeping habitat connected, especially with a changing climate where animals are moving up in elevation, but also north. We need this more than ever. And that's the single most important effort if we want to keep biodiversity around. And that's my lifelong project, Freedom to Roam, and I will continue to work on that.
Well, conservation is obviously something really important to you. Do you think the message is getting through to most people? Do most people care?
I think it's kind of going in waves. Sometimes people care, and then sometimes I think the lobbying groups are really efficient by always saying, oh, there's either conservation or your well-being. But I believe it goes hand in hand. We need a healthy planet if we want to have healthy communities. And right now, unfortunately, we are pressing the energy issue always at any cost. We don't think about drinking water. We don't think about, you know, clean environments and so on. I think it's the wrong approach, because there's a way of conserving energy, like what we're facing in Europe, where I'm coming from. And that's definitely a very effective way also to prevent, you know, the exploitation of all the areas.
One final question for you. What's it like spending all that time in the Arctic? I think sometimes months up to a year at a time, right?
5 months was the longest in one stretch. But yeah, I've been there.
What are the temperatures like in camping?
Yeah, literally. I mean, it goes down to minus 45. That good thing wasn't all that long. But you are sleeping in multiple layers in an extremely high quality sleeping bag. You have a breathing hole through which you breathe. And if you're in polar bear country, one of you has to actually take turns standing outside doing the polar bear guarding.
Mm-hmm. I guess you're lucky your wife goes along once in a while.
Yeah, she goes along once in a while. And she's from Mexico, of all places. And she never thought at the beginning she could ever last up there. But I think it's a mindset thing. Of course, other times I've been out with guides or with Inuit hunters. And it's been an adventure each and every time when we went on an expedition.
Florin Schultz is a wildlife photographer, an Arctic explorer, and a conservationist, and we thank you for sharing your adventure with us today.
Thank you so much, Steve, for having me on the show.
And time now for a look at the Cityscape calendar. New Line Theater's production of Next to Normal continues Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights at 8 o'clock through March 23rd at Washington University's South Campus Theater on Clayton Road. Dance St. Louis presents New York City Ballet Moves in performances tomorrow night at 8 and Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock at the Fox Theater. Ward Stair conducts the St. Louis Symphony Youth Orchestra in a concert highlighted by Brahms Symphony No. 4, Sunday afternoon, 3 o'clock in Pell Hall. And Jazz St. Louis presents the John and Gerald Clayton Double Bass and Piano Duo in sets at 7:30 and 9:30, Wednesday, Thursday, and next Friday, and Saturday nights at Jazz at the Bistro. And you can find out more about these and other events on the events section of stlpublicradio.org. And a final note, last December we talked with Patrick Jackson, the director of the Kirkwood High School Orchestra, about a concert to raise funds for their trip to New York's Lincoln Center to compete for the National Orchestra Cup. The competition took place last weekend, and the Kirkwood Orchestra took third place and received the award for the most original selection. So our congratulations to Patrick and his students. Next week on Cityscape, we're going to talk with the B-52's Fred Schneider about his appearance with the Gateway Men's Chorus, and Aaron Williams will introduce us to Blank Space, a no-holds-barred performing arts venue on Cherokee Street that is focused on being a community service advocate and arts incubator. And join Don Marsh Monday for St. Louis on the Air when he'll talk with Mary Beth Tinker on the 25th anniversary of her Supreme Court case concerning First Amendment rights of students. Archived versions of past Cityscape programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. Cityscape is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, engineered by Aaron Doerr, with production assistance from Spencer Reed and Drew Becker. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. Cityscape is made possible in part by the Arts and Education Council of Greater St. Louis, the Regional Arts Commission, and the Missouri Arts Council Estate Agency. Cityscape is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. I'm Steve Potter, and join us again next week.